For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. The Secretary of State's office says sometime next week it should know the exact number of signatures turned in by supporters of State Question 803 to recall permitless carry and put it before voters in 2020. The Secretary of State originally said the count would wait until after a Supreme Court challenge. Ryan, why do you think there was a change to go ahead with the signature count?
Well, I think that it makes a lot of sense. Your courts just in general, whether it's the Supreme Court of the state or the Supreme Court at the federal level, they generally don't like to weigh in on something unless they absolutely have to. They're very reluctant about any sort of pronouncements that could create precedent, that could create new law. And so if they get to the point where they don't have the signatures necessary for this to even be something for consideration on the ballot, there's really no sense for them to weigh in. And so this makes a lot more sense to me. Whenever when the Secretary of State originally said, we're going to hold off on the count and we're going to wait on this legal determination, it's like, well, if you're going to wait on a legal determination, but there doesn't have any need for it, then you're really putting the court in an awkward position of making a statement about something that may not even exist. And I think by all accounts, the signature collection was just amazing. I mean, they collected, nearly 60,000 and maybe over 60,000 signatures in 12 days. Odds are they fell a little bit short. I think that it demonstrates an enormous amount of intensity around this issue of permitless carry. I wouldn't be surprised if we don't see this as a standalone ballot question moving forward into November of 2020.
Neva?
I think that's right. I think the expectation is if indeed it does fall short, and that still remains to be seen. I mean, they could eke by and just barely have enough signatures, but actually have enough to get it on the ballot. So I think there seems to be, at least out there in general, a consensus that this is not an issue that's going to go away and that there is a great intent on the part of these folks to try to get it on the ballot in 2020.
And just go ahead,
Michael.
Well, I
was going to say, it probably makes it easier if they do it again, because right now the ballot question would be, should this go forward? Are you voting for the bill? Yes. Then if you don't like it, then you'd vote no. If you did it the right way, which would be, should it be repealed, you'd vote yes. And then, yeah.
Well, and they could potentially, craft the message. They could craft the ballot measure in a way that, maybe would go further, would be more targeted. I mean, they are bound by the statute that they're trying to invalidate here. And
right.
So that's the four corners that you have to operate in. And so if you go forward with your own ballot measure, you can start off by doing some polling to see where the people of Oklahoma are at, and then craft something that may be even more sweeping and of a reform than just invalidating a statute. Some inside baseball is interesting here. Commissioner Kevin Calvey in Oklahoma County, if you read the briefs that have been filed by the Second Amendment Association and the legislators that are trying to invalidate the referendum, Kevin Calvey is the attorney of record on that. So I just thought that was kind of interesting to see, former state legislator, current Oklahoma County commissioner, and serving as counsel on this case for the Second Amendment Association.
It is going to be fascinating, because when we think about, this was the very first bill that the governor signed into law. And this is something that when you talk about the issue with Second Amendment folks, and certainly the Oklahoma Second Amendment Association, which has been the driving force in opposition to this referendum effort, the whole bottom line is the bill does take effect November 1st, and I think for the Second Amendment folks, they would like to see some quick resolution on this so that it gets off the board. I think that's wishful thinking at this point, given the intensity that we're seeing out of the proponents on this referendum measure.
Well, now it'll go into effect even if they do start a ballot measure, right? I mean, even if they say, okay, well, this fails, this one, and then they start a ballot measure for 2020, that won't stop it from going into effect.
No, it'll go into effect November 1, even with the signature, even with the ballot measure, if the ballot measure moves forward, the effective date's November 1, and that's going to go into effect, regardless of whether or not this makes it on the ballot for a referendum on that statute that the governor signed last year or this year.
A state lawmaker files a bill to protect Oklahoma from federal red flag laws. Senator Nathan Dom wants to make sure the state doesn't have to adhere to laws attempting to take gun ownership away from people deemed dangerous. Neva, what do you think of this bill?
Well, I think like a lot of these bills, it's really seizing upon the national conversation on this issue more than what's going to take place in the legislature next year. I mean, when you look at the 17 states that have red flag laws, I mean, most of them, I think, if you were to classify them, they oftentimes are said to be left-leaning. I mean, these are states that have reacted, mainly on the eastern seaboard, have reacted to either shootings, a high school shooting, some of these mass shootings that have taken place. And when you really look at these individual states and the laws, they're kind of all over the board in terms of the petitioners that can, you know, start this process. They really widely vary. So I think for Oklahomans, I mean, there's not, again, a great deal of interest in this conversation. I think Congressman Frank Lucas, I mean, he made the point last week saying that the potential for abuse going down this road is incredible. And I think that is a takeaway that you hear quite frequently here in Oklahoma.
Right.
Well, if Senator Dom wants to invalidate some prospective federal law, and that's, I mean, it's very prospective. I mean, there's no imminent, there's no imminent likelihood that there's going to be a federal red flag law. I mean, the likelihood of any sort of meaningful gun reform making its way through Congress and then being signed by the president and then being enforced against the states, the odds of that are incredibly low. And so really what this is, I think, is Senator Dom trying to posture himself as he has many times before on the Second Amendment. And it's really about that, because if you want to invalidate a federal law, whether on its face or as it's applied to a state, you don't do it by filing a bill and saying we're going to nullify the law. You do it by going through the judiciary. If a law is unconstitutional, you challenge it in the courts. And if it's not unconstitutional, you know, surprise, the federal law is the supreme law of the land. I mean, that's stated in the United States Constitution. But it's not just stated in the United States Constitution. Folks that want to, you know, hang their hat on the mantle of states' rights and the 10th Amendment, and we reserve all these powers. Well, one of the powers that the state of Oklahoma exercised in the drafting of its own constitution was that early on, it says that the people of Oklahoma have a right to know that their laws are consistent with the federal laws and the federal United States mm-hmm. Constitution. And so just, you know, passing a bill that says we're going to nullify, that's just not how it's done.
Governor Stitt is shaking up the Department of Public Safety. Shortly after Commissioner Rusty Rhodes abruptly resigned on Labor Day, Stitt replaced him with Bureau of Narcotics Director John Scully. The agency is also losing Highway Patrol Chief Michael Harrell and DPS Assistant Commissioner Megan Simpson. Ryan, what do you think of this shakeup?
You know, I just, you know, first, you know, I want to, you know, say thanks to Commissioner Rhodes for his many years of public service. I mean, he's been a public servant even before he served at the top leadership position at the Department of Public Safety. I think that there has been a lot of, you know, chaos over the last several months with, you know, allegations where there are criminal allegations, and now we're dealing with civil suits in the agency as well. And so I can see how the governor wants to, you know, shake things up to create some continuity and some consistency and move some of, because a lot of the chaos does seem to revolve around personalities. You know, whether that's right or wrong, that's at least the perception. And so bringing new personalities in, I think the governor's trying to bring some stability there. I would say the biggest problem, and the governor said he wants to do this because there hasn't been a lot of action on Real ID and getting the state compliant with Real ID requirements. I'm not worried about that. You know what I'm worried about? I'm worried about DPS testing sites. If you look at, you know, driver's license testing sites around the state, that's the real critical shortcoming for the agency right now. Hours long waits. I mean, I've got to go in and get an eye test for a motorcycle endorsement. And, you know, I'm going in, I've got to go show up at the Southside Oklahoma City at 6:30 and get in line and wait 3 hours. And if you want to schedule an appointment, it's a month out. And if you look at rural sites, it's even worse. And so there are a lot of problems in DPS, and, you know, hopefully new leadership will be charged to do that, not just worry about Real ID.
Neva, John Scully, certainly no stranger to public safety as well.
Absolutely. I mean, here's someone who was with the State Narcotics Bureau for 3 years, but prior to that, he had been a career officer with the Oklahoma City Police Department. His last 8 years there, he was a deputy chief. So he's someone who has demonstrated strong management skills. And I think that is one of the things that the governor clearly indicated he was looking for, someone who could go in and kind of change the culture and clean up what needed to be done organizationally. And some of the things that Ryan's just mentioned have been concerns across the board with a lot of folks. So I think that, again, what we're seeing is the governor making a very direct effort to deal with an agency and put someone at the helm that he believes fits the management style that he's looking for.
This all goes back to legislation that was passed earlier this session that allowed him to basically hire and fire anybody in five different agencies, the Department of Public Safety being one of them. Are we done, do you think? Or we've still got mental health? We've still got
health department?
Yeah. Do you think there's going to be some more?
You know, I think it's difficult to tell. I mean, the governor seems to be really thinking about these decisions, but the thought process that isn't really, there's not a lot of transparency to it. He doesn't have a blog or something where he's like up at night journaling about, mm-hmm. These are my considerations. And so, this I think was probably something that's been the talk in the governor's office for quite some time. But then whenever you see these early retirements from Commissioner Rhodes and other folks within the department, it happens really fast. And so as the public, we're kind of left to digest and, kind of speculate as to what really was happening there and what's the real problem within the agency that the governor's trying to solve.
And if you remember, even back in February, Attorney General Hunter made the point that there needed to be policy changes within DPS. I mean, when he was talking about the promotions process and trying to make sure that there was no appearance of impropriety. I mean, so there have been a lot of issues swirling around, and now we have a new man at the helm. He'll go through Senate confirmation when they're back in session in February, but I think we'll see probably some fairly significant changes quickly.
And DPS is one of those agencies where obviously we've seen increased revenue and some new funding for the agency, but they're well behind what they need to actually accomplish the mission, whether that's testing sites or officers that are on the road for the Oklahoma Highway Patrol.
And I still have to wonder, is anyone concerned about the fact that there's going to eventually be a new governor, either in 2022 or 2026? If he or she comes in and then basically does the exact same thing, you've got now people in charge of agencies every 4 to 8 years.
I mean, that's kind of what we work with at the federal system. That's why state employees provide an enormous amount of continuity and intellectual knowledge to how these agencies work. We don't appreciate our state employees nearly as much. And I think that if we start to see higher turnover in these leadership positions, those folks that aren't political appointees, that haven't risen through the ranks by appointment by the governor or the Senate, and then confirmed by the Senate, those career employees that are going to really make sure that those agencies are accomplishing their missions.
And I would agree. I mean, much like the president, and you have the changing of an administration at the national level, at the state level, we are seeing kind of a different mindset being created. And I think even when a governor then runs for reelection, if they choose to, I mean, they have 4 years of history of what's gone on with the folks that they've put in place in these major agencies. Heads. And so I think that there will be a lot more scrutiny and there will be a lot more pressure, I think, on these folks to be able to deliver, or they probably won't be around for a long time.
The Federal Election Commission is flagging a bank loan taken out by Tulsa Congressman Kevin Hearn. This stems from a $650,000 loan from a bank Hearn helped create and govern. The loan was supposed to be paid back in June, but was restructured after he had only repaid $30,000 toward the principal. Neva, what do you think of this investigation?
Well, I think it's the paperwork process with the FEC. I mean, if you run for federal office, if you are in federal office and you have a campaign committee, you have very explicit rules that you must follow. And so this loan had to meet certain criteria when it was taken out. And then from a paperwork standpoint, on the last filing, even though that loan was restructured at the end of June, it should have been reflected on the paperwork that they received in Washington in July at the FEC. That didn't happen, so it triggered this investigation, so to speak. But really, it's for clarification and to make sure that what has been done meets the standard and that there's the proper follow through on the paperwork side.
Right.
Well, I think that it also shows that there's kind of real reliance on personal finances for Representative Hearn's fundraising and for the way he runs his campaigns. I mean, he outspent opponents in that Republican primary back in 2018 by almost a 2-to-1 margin, if not greater. He outspent his Republican or his Democratic opponent in the general election by like, you know, 2 million to 400,000. But he's bringing in a lot of this money on his own. He's made personal investments in the campaign, and now he's got this loan. Most of us couldn't walk in and get a loan of that size without any sort of collateral at that interest rate. I mean, that's to me, I mean, I'm not saying that there's anything untoward or illegal about it, but it does kind of demonstrate that the ability to have access. I mean, if you're part of a bank and you're part of the leadership and you can walk in and get a loan like this without that kind of collateral, that's not the experience of most folks in the first district. I don't think it's a good look for the congressman. And it is interesting moving into the 2020 election cycle. If he wants to hang on to that congressional seat, it may not be a Democrat that unseats him, but if Republicans are out there, I mean, Senator Nathan Dom, I mean, he's obviously positioning himself politically with the Second Amendment conversation that he's having right now with voters. I mean, if Senator Dom, who challenged him in that primary before, were to come at him again, I don't think that Congressman Hearn is in a position financially to really say that he's going to scare off primary opponents.
Neva, he does run a re-election campaign next year, although it might not be illegal according to the FEC or anything else. Is he concerned, or should he be concerned about any kind of feeling of impropriety there?
I don't think folks, the voters don't pay a lot of attention to you know, how much money is being raised and how much money is being spent. That's kind of the inside baseball, the backside that the political types, you know, pay attention to. He has only about $100,000 in his campaign account right now, and yet he's got over $1 million in outstanding loans, all of that to him, or at least the biggest percentage. He put $800,000 into the campaign in just personal money in addition to the bank loan that he took out. So does he have the capacity to continue to do that in a re-election? Will he have a serious challenge in a re-election campaign? That all remains to be seen. But, you know, the FEC stuff goes on in every campaign at the presidential level all the way down to the House and Senate races. So this is not something that's highly unusual, but it is serious, and the FEC really has high expectations that these folks take care of business and do the paperwork exactly pro forma of what they're supposed to.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, as Neva said, the bigger issue here is that ratio of debt in the campaign to cash on hand for an incumbent member of Congress. I mean, if you look at Congresswoman Kendra Horn, I mean, her fundraising is through the roof. And if you look at, you know, debt, I mean, it's virtually non-existent. And, you know, now, given Congresswoman Horn is going to be one of the most she's going to be the subject of one of the most targeted campaigns to knock out an incumbent anywhere in the country. The 5th District in Oklahoma is going to be a highly intense competitive race moving
into
2022.
Whereas Hearns might not be that.
Where Hearns might not be. But if I'm a political consultant and somebody comes to me and they say, well, do you want to run against an incumbent? Normally you say not. But if you are a Republican and you want to challenge Congressman Hearn right now, you look at that debt to cash on hand ratio and you say, here's a person who has some liabilities that most incumbents do not.
But if you're a Republican looking at challenging a sitting member of Congress, you better have a pretty deep pocket yourself or a lot of friends. Because the reality is when they get into a campaign and they really have to get into the full throttle campaign mode, they're going to be able to raise that money not only in state but back in Washington, D.C. from the folks that want to see them return.
The governor's mansion is currently empty, awaiting extensive repairs. The more than 90-year-old 14,000-square-foot home apparently needs a lot of work, and lawmakers allocated about $2 million for repairs. Apparently, work needs to be done on windows, roofing, plumbing, and even removing mold. Ryan, did you know the house had gotten this bad?
Well, I don't know that we'd all known that it had gotten this bad, but maybe it's a metaphor for the state. We've got a lot of deferred maintenance. And, I think that there are questions now that the governor's office is taking seriously about whether the governor's mansion itself should remain a residence. Because if it's remaining a residence, that creates additional upkeep and maintenance and repair cost that maybe just restoring it to the point that it becomes almost a museum or an attraction or something used for special events, and then the first family is housed somewhere else. I mean, I do think that there are some important reasons why we have things like the governor's mansion. I think that it's like these democratic norms, you know, that regardless of who is in power, they occupy these certain places. Right. And I think that it helps us, you know, respect the because those individuals that occupy that, they occupy by the virtue of the people. And so to put them there and to remove them from their normal houses, but to put them there, I think, is a democratic norm that there's some arguable importance to. But then the question remains, is it worth spending this much money? And if we're spending it now, what are we going to be spending in 10, 15, 20 years?
Neva.
Well, I mean, this is not a new conversation. I mean, Mary Fallon, back in 2015, there was conversation about her moving out of the mansion for 6 months and making some of these very needed renovations and changes. At that point, it was a financial consideration. Now we're, you know, back to the drawing board. The first family is not going to stay in the governor's mansion this year. And I think we will see many of these things addressed. The question will be the price tag. I mean, the legislature, I believe, has appropriated $2 million. Some of the early estimates were, you know, triple that or
six,
higher.
$7 million.
So,
yeah.
So you know, it is a cost factor, but it's like our capital. I mean, when you reach a point with buildings that are, you know, approaching 100 years old or in need of great repair, then you have a situation where from the vantage point of this is the people's home, this is the people's capital, then you have to take those things into account, and there is a cost related to it. Now, the conversation, which it seems to be brewing, of whether or not to build another governor's residence or mansion, you know, perhaps even on the grounds there behind the original building, which was built in 1928,
yeah.
And do that with non-appropriated dollars, do it with private funds. I think that's a conversation that we may see some serious action on in the near future. So I think that the bottom line is we have a situation where at least we're now seeing something happen that's long overdue, and hopefully they will be able to do it in a fashion that is quick so that the people do have an opportunity. This is a place where people can come, at least see the first floor, see the history of the governor's mansion, and I think it's something that we should take care of, and it's long overdue.
And there's security that you have to think about as well, because right now they're staying in a home run by the National Guard. So you can't just have him buy a house in Nichols Hills. There's got to be some kind of security issues you've got to deal with.
Yeah, and I like the idea that it's proximate to the Capitol, you know, that it's walking mm-hmm. distance. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if Governor... I don't know if Governor Stitt ever walks.
Walk.
He may. I mean, I don't know. I mean, he rode a tractor to the Capitol once. I mean, he may walk. But, you know, I like the proximity to the Capitol.
Sure.
I think that it's just this, you know, I think symbolism in a democracy, it can be important and it can be powerful and remind us mm-hmm. of who is in power and how we hold them accountable and what their roles are. And so, you know, I think a lot of the decisions and the discussion are going to be geared towards this, are going to be decided without a lot of input. They're going to be decided by the second round of bids that come in. And if we see second round bids that come in again, $4-6 million, and there's really no way to get below that point, I think that decision is going to be to have a separate residence, whether it's on the grounds or somewhere else, is going to be expedited.
And turn this one into just a museum. And a place where people can go for
meetings and just like the additional facility that was built on the grounds, the Phillips Pavilion that was done during the Keating administration. I mean, it has a great deal of use by both people in government, but certainly private citizens and other groups who use that. So it is a facility just adjacent to the Capitol that people know where it is. That there's a high level need to be able to have this as a facility that is that's functioning, and that we have all of these issues that have already been outlined addressed, because they are long overdue.
And Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.